Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Ramat Poudinet, who's Senior Research Fellow at the OIS. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from his recent paper, Energy Networks in the Energy Transition Era, that was published by the Institute in early May 2022. Just to kind of timestamp this recording in this ever-changing world, we're recording it on the 17th of May 2022 in the morning. Ramat, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Nice to be here, David.
Ramat, why don't we start by asking you about the electricity transmission network? You know, do we still need investment in transmission network given the growth of decentralization in the electricity sector?
This is true that decentralization paradigm is gaining momentum in the electricity sector, but still we require investment in the transmission network for two important reasons. One is that the location of the new major resources like onshore and offshore wind are often far away from the load centers. And the other reason is that in the recent years, the need for interconnectivity between electricity markets are being increasingly recognized as a way to improve economic efficiency as well as security of energy supply. And both of these two important aspects require investment in transmission networks.
Okay, so what are the key issues in relation to investment in transmission networks, therefore?
The thing is that the design and construction of the new transmission assets is a complex and a costly process and often has a very long lead time. And at the same time, we have uncertainty about the future development in the energy sector. For example, there is uncertainty about the timing and pace of the decarbonization of heating and transport. And there are multiple options to decarbonize each of these two sectors. So one challenge particularly is to ensure that any future investment in the transmission network is sort of robust in the face of a range of possible transition pathways outcomes for the heating and also for the transport sector. The other point is that because of the suboptimal design of the electricity markets in many places, including the European area and the UK, transmission network congestions are often not reflected in electricity market prices. And because of these, transmission constraints are managed by a redispatch of flexibility resources, either in a cost-based or in a market-based fashion. And this at some times can be very costly. So when this sort of congestion happens, a question that arises is that do we really need more investment in transmission network, or we really need a better market design? And the final point is that although investment in wire and transformers are sometimes really necessary to deal with network issues because the nature of some of the network congestions are such that they really necessitate investment in wire and transformers, when more efficient non-network solutions are available, grid operators really need to be incentivized to prioritize those solutions because just focusing on asset-based solution may not really achieve efficiency in relation to investment in transmission network and also ensuring that sufficient capacity is available for security of energy supply.
Okay, so how are distribution networks affected by the transformation of the electricity sector then?
Well, with the growth of the renewables, the importance of distribution grid has increased actually more than ever. In Europe region, including the UK, for instance, it is expected that around 70% of the cumulative generation capacity that is going to be installed by 2030 to be connected to distribution grid. At the same time, we have also the rise of decentralized resources, which is, in my opinion, one of the most important trends in the electricity sector. We have rooftop solar panels, which are now being combined with stationary battery storage. We have electric vehicles. We have smart home devices. And all these basically transform passive consumers into engaged and active ones, which they are now being called prosumers. The other thing is that As consumers shift to electric vehicles and they start to use higher amount of electricity for heating and cooling, meeting electricity demand and specifically dealing with its uncertainty and variability will be a challenge for electricity the distribution networks, because these networks will face increasing level of constraints, particularly with regard to the connection of the new users, like, for instance, new solar PVs or new wind farm. And most of the time, these sort of congestion lead to increased connection costs to pay for network reinforcement. And finally, another issue is that the distribution networks are originally designed to distribute out electricity from centralized power generation to end user. But now, because of these things that are happening in the electricity sector as a result of energy transition, these networks are experiencing completely a different environment in which we have a lot of decentralized resources, as well as bidirectional flows, which not only coming from the transmission to distribution, but also in a reverse manner from the distribution to the transmission. And this is a new challenge for distribution companies that they need to actually deal with.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I talk from experience, as I have solar panels, I have batteries, I have an electric car. And so all these things are from separate suppliers and not linked, which is linked technically, but not linked software-wise, which is a bit of a frustration. But anyway, let's get back to the podcast. So what are the regulatory instruments that are available to address challenges which distribution network companies face?
Well, network constraints can be managed by a range of instruments, like by providing alternative types of connection agreements, or through the use of flexibility mechanism, or through efficient network tariff design. At the moment, the main method of the connection is so-called firm connection agreement, which basically means that the consumer is given the option of having access up to the capacity of its fuse. The problem with this method is that it can prevent new users from being connected, because when you have the option of being connected to the maximum limit of your fuse, your profile of the load often is in a way that you rarely reach the maximum load that you have option to use from the grid. And a big part of the network components are remaining idle throughout the year. But on the contrary, if we introduce a flexible connection agreement, this can solve the problem to a great extent. The second instrument that can help with the efficient use of the network is a flexibility mechanism. Distribution network operator often do not actually solve the congestion. And when they do, it is either in a load shedding or in a form of a generation curtailment. Flexibility services that is coming from resources like distributed generation, storage, or demand response provided by consumers, they actually can reduce the need for network reinforcement, and ultimately they can reduce the cost to end users. And finally, we have the network tariff, which is an important instrument in the hand of the regulator to ensure networks are efficiently utilized. An efficient network tariff not only can recover the regulated network cost, but also can promote efficient behavior in the sense that the avoiding congestion in the short term and in the long term, lowering the need for network reinforcement.
Okay, Ramat, so before we kind of talk about integrated energy networks, let's talk about natural gas networks for a while. In your view, what does the future look like for natural gas networks?
Well, things are sort of uncertain when it comes to the future of natural gas. In countries with net zero objectives like that of the UK, it all depends to what's going to happen to the gas demand in main gas consuming sector like the residential sector and the industry. Any change in the gas demand, for instance, in the power generation, will affect the gas transmission network. Any change in the gas demand in the residential sector, on the other hand, will affect the both transition and the distribution grid. One source of uncertainty here is policy. We know that, for example, for the power generation, decarbonization pathway is almost clear. But when it comes to the domestic heating and industrial process load, there is a wide range of possible decarbonization options. This includes electrification, hydrogen from renewables, biogas, or synthetic gas. So this all makes it a sort of actually difficult to see what's going to happen. There is also technology uncertainty in relation to the penetration of CCUS and uptake of the negative emission technologies. On a global level, we have other issues, like, for instance, to what extent there's going to be a call to gas switching, or how, to what extent natural gas is going to be used for hydrogen production and also production of the green hydrogen. So overall, it's a bit difficult to make a prediction about the future of the natural gas networks in a sort of, reliable manner.
Okay, but given that the future is so difficult to predict, in your opinion, what are the possible scenarios for the future of natural gas networks?
Well, if we can envision a world in which there is no CCS technology available economically, and the decarbonization of heating has been mainly based on the district heating and electrification, then we may see a scenario in which substantial decommissioning of the gas network will happen. But of course, such a scenario requires addressing several challenges, including, for instance, the problem of the seasonal and daily energy storage capacity, which will be lost in countries like the UK if we decommission the substantial part of the gas network. The second problem with this scenario is that how to determine the decommissioning cost and how to treat the the cost of these decommissioning the gas networks, because who should pay for these costs is not really an easy question to answer. Another scenario for natural gas network is to maintain it for a small number of the larger industrial customer. Well, this scenario basically means that we keep the network and we recover the cost of the network from just a few large consumers. In terms of the problem that it can create, I can say that, for instance, apart from the issue of the higher network tariff, because the network costs are going to be recovered from a smaller number of consumers, there is still the issue of the investment in network in this scenario, because of the possibility of the network investment can be becoming stranded. If, for instance, there is a risk of some of the existing gas consumers to sort of switch from the gas to alternative fuel in future in case they become cheaper. So there would be significant investment risk for network operator under such a scenario. And a third scenario that I can mention is to repurpose the gas network to carry decarbonized gases, for instance, like hydrogen. And this scenario is something that the many countries are looking into it, but it requires dealing with a range of important challenges. One is that when you start something like that, for instance, a hydrogen business, at the beginning, the volume of the hydrogen may not be sufficiently large to sort of making the adjustment of the existing gas network economically a sensible strategy. Another problem is that the hydrogen can be transported by various means, including not only gas pipeline or new pipelines, but also through railroad, to waterways, to roads, and also through electricity networks. So repurposing the gas network infrastructure to carry hydrogen may not be always the optimal solution. Of course, a mix of these scenarios is also possible based on the specific needs and specific features of a country or region, but these scenarios are the possible sort of outcome for the future of natural gas, including converting it to carry hydrogen.
Okay, but let's pick up and talk more about hydrogen networks. Now, what are the kind of key challenges of deployment to a hydrogen network?
Well, as I mentioned, hydrogen can be transported by various means. Some of these modes, like, for instance, road or rail or marine transport, are competitive, whereas others, like, for instance, gas pipeline or electricity networks, are natural monopolies. This intermodal competition makes it sort of difficult to determine the extent of the need for natural monopoly infrastructure, either by converting existing natural gas networks or, for instance, by deploying new dedicated infrastructure. Basically, the regulator cannot easily specify how the demand for hydrogen transport will be shared by various modes. So to avoid inefficiency, we need a whole system view of the transportation of the hydrogen, and rather than just focusing on one mode, like, for instance, repurposing the existing natural gas infrastructure. The second issue is that the hydrogen power plants are mostly unregulated at the moment, but in future, we need a regulatory framework for them. And this is to make sure there is sufficient investment happening in this network, and also the existing commercially driven investment in hydrogen pipeline are sort of becoming integrated in future regulated hydrogen network, and the risk of them to be becoming incompatible or stranded to become minimized through the regulatory framework. And finally, like any other national monopoly, hydrogen pipelines require a framework for third-party access to prevent the discriminatory behavior by the infrastructure operator. So these are the sort of challenges that probably we are going to face when we want to deploy hydrogen networks.
Okay, so kind of let's talk beyond the main energy networks, because your paper also discusses heating and cooling networks. So what role do these networks play in relation to decarbonization objectives?
Well, decarbonization of the space and water heating and space cooling are one of the important challenges of achieving net zero carbon objective. At the moment, the global demand for heating is sort of higher than that of cooling, but but prediction shows that by 2060, energy demand for cooling is going to overtake that of the heating. Specifically, energy demand for space cooling is growing faster than any other energy use in building. And some of the data shows that it has been tripled between 1990 and 2016, mainly because of the economic and population growth in the global south. There are various options for decarbonization of heating and cooling, but in areas with high load density, heating and cooling networks are a sort of a cost-efficient way of providing heating and cooling services. Cooling networks are much less common at the moment compared with heating networks, but both have similar advantages. For example, they can provide significant economies of scale. Also, these networks can use local sustainable resources, which obviously reduce the carbon emission and improve the security of energy supply. Again, like any other network, like gas and electricity network, heating and cooling networks are also national monopolies. When a consumer is connected to the heating or cooling networks, they usually don't have other alternatives to receive heating and cooling services. So these networks also need to be regulated to make sure that the network development is happening in an efficient way. And also, we need a procedure for setting the price of access to the network, quality of the service that we receive from these networks, and also other issues like the ownership model of the heating and cooling network, third-party access, and other important aspects. So these sort of issues needs to be addressed in order for the heating and cooling networks to become important part of the initiatives on the decarbonization of the heating and cooling.
And I'm sure that will happen, but as you said, there's certainly a lot of work to be done before that. So in your paper, you talk about the concept of integrated networks. Can you perhaps explain to our listeners, what does this mean and why is it so important?
Well, we know that the traditionally energy networks like electricity, gas, heating and cooling are planned and operated independently of each other, which obviously this results in loss of synergies and efficiency. But these once separate infrastructure and are now becoming increasingly interconnected through network coupling technologies like combined cycle gas turbine, or combined heat and power unit, or more recently to power to X technologies, for example, power to hydrogen, power to ammonia, power to heating, power to cooling. The key point is that an integrated approach to the planning and operation of this network can lower the use of primary energy that we have, and also provide higher flexibility and lower the cost of overall achieving a net zero carbon target. In terms of the how does the integrated energy network works, I can say that there are three layers of the integration which are important to network. One is that if we think of a specific network like a gas or electricity One layer of the integration is requires a high coordination between the transmission and distribution system operator within the sector. Like, for instance, between the electricity transmission and the electricity distribution operator, or gas transmission operator and the gas distribution operator. The second layer of integration involves a higher level of coordination between network and unregulated activities like the generation and supply. This level of integration actually is important because after liberalization, as a result of the high emphasis that was placed on the competition and unbundling, any coordination and synergy as a result of the, integrated planning and operation of the generation and network was lost. So in order to improve the coordination between the network business and the competitive business like the generation and supply, in recent years, we see that the regulatory framework of network companies are being designed in a way to sort of incentivize a network operator to account for the higher benefit that they can get from the coordination with generation and with demand. The third layer is cross-sectoral integration, which basically means that they utilize the synergy that exists between various energy networks, including gas, electricity, hydrogen, and heating. This level of integration has been historically limited, even prior to liberalization. And now the aim is that to improve the coordination between various networks, because it can bring a lot of benefit. Just an example, for instance, is that sometimes a solution for a particular network challenge, like, for instance, a challenge that is on the electricity transmission network, can be found on a different network, either on the distribution side or on a completely different network like the hydrogen network. So when this happens, in order to maximize the benefits, the network operator needs to be incentivized to refrain from making unnecessary investment when a cheaper solution is available outside its network. This basically means that the future investment in any particular energy networks cannot be just based on the supply and demand scenario in that sector. It also needs to be sort of coordinated with the production, consumption, and infrastructure developments in other sectors.
Okay, well, look, as we kind of come to the end of this podcast, I'd like just to ask one final question, if I may. How do you think we should achieve an integrated energy network?
Achieving an integrated energy network requires an institutional setting which promotes coordination in planning and operation of different energy networks. One way is to change of the governance. For example, we establish a central planner who coordinates planning and operation of different energy networks. Example of this is the current discussion in the UK about establishing an impartial future system operator with responsibility across both gas and electricity networks. Under certain conditions, an integrated network can also be achieved through market-based approaches. In other words, through the actions of the individual decentralized agents who respond to the network access and utilization price signal. For example, when hydrogen network users switch between various modes of the hydrogen delivery in response to a price signal, then it leads to an overall efficient level of hydrogen transport infrastructure expansion across each mode. But for this to happen, we need to have a network process which are free from any subsidies or taxes or any sort of distortion. This condition cannot be met in many places, so achieving an integrated approach to market is not really very straightforward. The other way to achieve an integrated network is through economic regulation. In this way, basically, regulation of network companies needs to be adjusted so that grid operator incentivizes to make investment operation decision that maximizes the net social benefits of the entire energy system rather than their own network. So the ultimate aim here is that to avoid possible misalignments between the choices that optimizes the individual network planning and versus that optimizes the entire energy system. These are the basically three ways that the I can envision that can be utilized in order to achieve an integrated energy network in future.
Oramat, you know, thank you so much again for your time today. I always enjoy our conversations, and this particular one builds on the messages from your recently published paper, Energy Networks in the Energy Transition Era, that was published by the OIS in May 2022, and is, of course, on our website for download. I hope you all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.